From the hip.
Well, hello, and welcome to what is the 49th episode of the... That's stupid. Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
Da, 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 da.
Hello. Hello, and welcome to the 49th episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and...
Me, Scott Casson-Rennie. Woo-hoo.
Well, Scott, you're Woo-hoo. Excited, aren't you? I can tell.
I'm very giddy tonight. I'm so giddy tonight. I think, I don't know if it's because I'm just uber tired. And
uber
I've just
tired.
Spent like last how many hours on a train just sitting, going at 10 miles an hour. Or if it's just because I'm really excited about our podcast. 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 Yeah.
Podcast, right. So should we crack on and just go straight to it? Tell us who it is.
Well, tonight we're talking to Dr. Lucy Peake, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Grandparents Plus. And that's why I'm really excited. Because not only is she lovely, because we've met her, and I think you've met her again since.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just see so much. There's differences. Yes, there is, before anyone writes in and complains.
Oh.
But there's also a lot of similarities, and I'm just really interested to talk to her because it's just something that really, really interests me. Anything to do with permanence really interests me. So, yeah, so really excited about talking to her.
Excellent. Well, shall we go and we shall go straight to it?
Let's find her on the internet, lad.
And patch her in.
Aye.
Patch her in.
Please hold caller. Switchboard.
Yes. Is that going to work? Hello, Lucy. Oh, you're still there. I think I've accidentally got you on both on two calls. I think I've totally cocked that up. Let me see. Hello, Lucy. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Al.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine. I might have to do a bit. I think I've accidentally opened up two calls as opposed to one call. So can I shut you down and start you again, please?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine.
Okay, I'll be straight back to you.
In a minute.
Scott.
Yes.
I did a terrible thing. I didn't add it. I accidentally just... I don't know how I did that. That's totally stupid.
So what do you need to do?
If I knew that, I'd be bloody clever, wouldn't I? Honestly.
You'd also be very rich.
I'd be incredibly rich. With like a master of the internet. Oh, how do I add? Normally it's so easy. All right, add. Right, add to call. Lucy Peake. Yeah. Add.
Whoop, whoop. Give it a minute.
Wait for it. Hello, Lucy.
Hiya.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks.
Good.
Hello.
Stranger, all right.
Yes. Can you hear us both okay?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yep.
I'll give you a brief overview of our cunning plan. Is that we have just, it's very conversational. There's no ulterior motives. We're not out to trick you or get you to promise to do something on a like a company level. If you say anything that you think, oh, I shouldn't have said that, please just say, I shouldn't have said that, and then we'll just cut it out. Or if you wake in the night screaming, going, oh, what have I said? Then just message me and I'll...
And he'll sort it out at 3 in the morning.
And I'll post it on the internet and everyone will know. No, I'll just sort it out. There's no trick questions. We're very casual, very informal. So we've done a little intro and basically we're pretending that we're really competent and we just pressed a button and then you came online. So I think, Scott, you're going to kind of lead this interview through. I've given you a list of questions.
Well, hopefully this will be easier than Martin Barrow's one, yeah?
Oh.
This afternoon.
Yes, it got a bit fighty.
It was fun. I loved it. I loved it.
It was a bit fighty. You're going to have to come quite close to your microphone, Lucy, because you're using the mic on your device, aren't you? Not headphones. So if
all
you
right.
could... We've got...
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Am I loud enough?
That's cool. Okay, so Scott, if you could go for it.
Yeah. So as we've just said, we are joined this evening by Dr. Lucy Peak. And how are you, Lucy?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good.
Great to be with you.
Oh, well, we're delighted you've come, actually, because I think we've been trying to get you on for a while, or we talked about it, then it all went quiet, and then and we're back on again. But anyway, never mind. It's happening now. It's happening here and right now.
Hello, Lucy, and I've just by told... the way. Hello, Lucy.
Oh, sorry. And you've obviously met
Dr. Lucy,
the co-host.
Yeah, I'll just stay quiet over here.
and I was just saying to Al there, I'm a bit giddy tonight, because this is... podcast is really excited me, because I think there's loads to discuss. So I think what we'll do is, if you can, for those that don't know you, just give a brief introduction to yourself and tell us all about yourself.
All right. So I'm Lucy. I've been the chief executive at Grandparents Plus for 3 years almost, and it's been a really exciting time. I think we are in quite an exciting time for special guardianship and kinship care in general. There's more interest than there has been in the past, but also I think there's some uniqueness in what we do as Grandparents Plus, which has just attracted funders, and we're growing things, so it's all very exciting. I'd say that my immediate previous role at the Fostering Network has been incredibly important, really, for me in understanding the wider sort of context that we operate in. So I've been there for nearly 10 years, so quite a long time in development roles. So initially I was involved in policy and the campaigning side, but I moved over into more of a program development role. So some of the things I look back at being involved in, things like staying put, extension, so really recognising that ongoing relationship that young people need with carers.
Yeah.
The Mockingbird model, introduction of that, again, just real importance of stability and relationships and people being around a child and a young person, to give them what they need. So a lot of that has been really relevant to bring across to Grandparents Plus, and it's fantastic what's happening at the moment.
And just to pick up on something you said there, a more interest. Why do you think there is more interest in these other forms of permanence that include birth families?
I think there's been a recognition of the numbers of children. So we've seen more and more children placed with special guardianship orders. And so it's probably inevitable that over time there would be a greater focus on them. Mm. So we really welcome the government's extension of, the Adoption Special Guardianship Leadership Board to include special guardianship.
Yeah.
As a charity, there are still issues, though, around that quite narrow focus on those children who were previously looked after. So we will continue to talk about all kinship carers, all children and young people in kinship care. We think we need to widen our focus on all of them. There's just too much of a disparity in support at the moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and what sort of? Sorry, Al, you're not getting the word in tonight, are you?
No, I've got questions.
Honestly, you've got questions.
I've got loads of questions, No, I'm not going to get in. I'm sorry. Let's not bicker in front of guests.
Oh, dear me. Well, it's interesting because the staying put program that you talked about as well, that really interested me, because I didn't hear about that until after it kind of become a thing, if that makes sense. So what was your involvement with that?
It took years. Mm-hmm. I give credit to lots of people at the Fostering Network, because it was a campaign that started, as these things do, with some consultation with young people and foster carers, led to a policy paper. And it was probably about 8 years of lobbying until the time came when we could get that into government legislation. And even then, the funding doesn't always follow. So the take-up at first was lower than we'd have hoped, because there wasn't enough funding for local government to implement it properly. But it was a really proud moment to be part of the Fostering Network when that was implemented. I think it was a bit of a step change, really, to say that we shouldn't be expecting young people to leave as early as we had been. That was kind of setting them up to fail in some way.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like common sense to me that, you know, you wouldn't do the same to a child who, you know, you raised and brought up, and then, you know, you wouldn't say to them at 18, right, we're done now. You know, and the same with adoption, and I'm sure with some special guardians as well, they're exactly the same. It's just common sense, isn't it, that shouldn't end just because they turn 18.
Yeah, and I think that's why it almost resonated with so many people, because there was a colleague of mine went to the House of Commons with young people, and they interviewed MPs and said, do you have children? When would you expect them to leave? And nobody said 16. You know, so it's almost like everybody could see it. And in a sense, that's quite relevant for thinking about kinship care, because it's such an obvious thing that people step in to help, you know, when things go on in the family. But it doesn't mean that those people don't need some attention and some support. You know, it's too invisible.
It was a fantastic campaign that was really... I remember seeing there was a birthday card, wasn't there, one aspect of it, which was welcome, you know, happy 18th birthday. Here's your, mm-hmm. I can't remember, but it was goodbye sort of thing. Because we, obviously I work in fostering, and we'd seen it, and it's a sucker punch. It's just totally, this is what happens. Children are literally, they're timing out, and then totally, you know, at 18. In this big wide world, which we just don't expect from our own children.
Yeah. And we have, in kinship care, in a sense, it's better because there is that relationship that continues. Mm. So our research on outcomes for young people who've grown up in kinship care suggests that that continuity of that relationship with the primary carer that then continues as long as young people need it. Even if they choose to leave early, you know, some young people are still choosing to leave their household when they're young, we would say quite young. The carer is still there for them, so you've got that ability to bounce back when you need it. And, you know, it's that thing that we would hope for all our children, wouldn't we, that if they leave and then they need to come back, we're still there for them.
Don't talk to us about that. I tell you, we're feeling the burn, aren't we, Scott?
A little bit.
We love them dearly.
I love being a parent.
My oldest is 13, so I'm not there yet.
Oh. Well, you know where we are when you get to that.
Come and see us. Blimey.
Oh, dear me. So looking a little bit further into, you know, SGOs and kinship care and stuff, what are some of the unique challenges that these guys are facing? And when I say guys, I'm just using that as a kind of term of loving, in terms of they're just, you know, I guess we know it's very different in some ways, but in some ways it's so much the same. And I think that's why I'm a little bit giddy tonight, so you'll have to forgive me. But, you know, what are these unique kind of challenges that they're facing, because they're quite obviously going to be different to adoption, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. So when I talk about special guardians and kinship carers, probably worth me saying I'm really talking about kinship carers, so it's family members who've stepped in to raise a child, and they might be anyone from a family and friends foster carer, special guardian, child arrangements order, residence order, or nothing. The Grandparents Plus proudly supports all of them, and so I kind of will talk about them all. And the thing that they've got in is they are family who've stepped in, irrespective of that legal order. And of course, the key thing that's different is that they are family. Often it's not planned, so if they've stepped in some kind of crisis. The other thing is finance, so we could talk a lot about finance. Yeah. And just the ongoing issues for them, particularly around contact and relationships within the family. So there's a lot of things that we could start to explore that play out as real challenges, I think, for kinship carers. So, you know, if we started like with the first one, that kind of step in crisis, you would contrast that with adoption and fostering, where you have time to think, you are offered training, you meet people who've gone through it, you get, you know, some advice and information about your options and what support will be available. What happens with kinship care is often they're just thrown into it. So their instinct almost is to take that child and make them safe as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But that puts them at almost a disadvantage because they don't have necessarily the time to find out their legal options, the support they can ask for. They might be nervous to ask for that support because they're worried that that baby they've picked up from hospital is, you know, could be adopted if they ask for too much. And, you know, I think there is often for them that it's almost like a retreat. It's the child comes with you, you make that child safe, and you retreat from services as quickly as you can. You know, the very best services would be supporting that kinship carer from a very early stage to understand what's about to happen, the challenges that lay ahead, the support they might need.
Can I ask about that? Because one of the nuances is that if you, and there's a movement that's just started, this same children but not lack, I can't remember the name of it. This idea, that if your child is gone into foster care, then comes out of foster care, then immediately the different systems move into place. You know, prepil premium plus on a really basic level, but they're as previously looked after children, they're then entitled to all kinds of resources. But if it's that dash in the night, that phone call at midnight, and the child comes straight into that carer's house, then they're not, and that's a huge injustice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's massive. So, and when we talk about that, what's your instinct telling you to do? So, the carer who she works a lot with us, she made that dash in the night. Her daughter had mental health issues and was using drugs, and there was a call from the neighbours. She went round there, she picked up the two toddlers, took them home, left them with her partner, and then went back and, you know, sought to make her daughter safe in a really difficult situation.
Yeah.
But that was deemed to be an informal private arrangement because she'd rushed over there before the police had kind of made that call to the social services. And from then on, like within days, she was told, you've got to get money together, get to court, get yourself a child arrangements order. She didn't ever have time in that crisis of almost like trying to keep her daughter safe and look after the two toddlers to kind of get that advice that she needed. So then, you know, after that crisis period, she'd given up work because what else could she do? She found us and she's still fighting for support and it's years on. And that's not an untypical situation that we have. So you're absolutely right. It's almost like to access support, you have to become a looked after child, which is actually against the guidance. You know, children shouldn't have to do that, but it's almost the way the system's set up, and it's being made more obvious by things like extension of adoption support fund for some children and people who need some children. Yes. But I think, you know, carers are spotting that, and that's why that campaign's come about.
Yeah, the lack of lack, isn't it? That's the lack of lack status campaign. Sorry, Scott.
No, I was just going to, before we kind of move on from the crisis bit that you're talking about, Lucy, because I used to sit on the panel for permanence, and bearing in mind this was probably about 5-6 years ago. And I always remember really thinking, and I'm not sure how I feel about this now that I know so much more, but I always remember thinking when we had kinship carers or, what's the other one that they used to, I'm not so sure it's common now, but it's, what's it called? It's got a C in there somewhere. I can't remember what the
person.
Yeah, connected person, that's all, thank you.
Yes, come and listen to the podcast while two men think about things they've forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. Can't remember their words. And I always remember thinking the difference, because there was this fear, of course there is a fear about their, you know, their relatives, you know, whether it's grandchild or nephew or, you know, cousin twice removed or whatever, being removed from the family. And it almost seemed like it was so rushed And the assumption was, and I don't know how you, what your thoughts are on this piece specifically, but the assumption was that even though they came to a permanence panel, before they got there, it was assumed that the children would stay with them. Mm. I mean, to me, that's just, that's a journey that you would expect. But actually, in terms of lack of support and preparation, is that the right way to do it? Or, you know, I mean, I'm just not sure. My mind's not made up on it, because it seems unfair to, you know, to put the children in a position and the family in a position where they might not be able to help.
I mean, there's lots of people who think that the timescales for assessment are too short.
Yeah.
So I think it's wise for us all to look at that, because if you put everything together, you've got the crisis in the family, you've often got a lack of information about what the child's gone through. So some of the information you get as a prospective adopter, you don't get. So, you know, the medical reports, the child's history and so on. So it's quite hard for a prospective kinship carer to really understand what the impact of the child's experience is likely to be and what support they may need to have in place. So there's not that same discussion and consideration that you might be able to have as a foster carer or an adopter. Mm. And there's been none of that training for kinship carers that foster carers and adopters have, you know, understanding attachment and, you know, impact of trauma and so on.
Mm.
What some people say happens is there's the crisis, the child is placed, the order is made, the services and support kind of fall away, sometimes immediately, sometimes over, you know, 3 to 6 months. And you may have that honeymoon period when you think everything's going to be fine, you know, the baby's with me now, or the 6-year-old with me. And then over time, things become more apparent. But the problem for kinship carers is the door is closed unless the child is previously looked after when it's more open.
Mm.
So I think there's something about the assessment process doesn't give enough time for people to really understand it. And I think that's because of everything going on.
Yeah.
And natural instinct that you step up and you say, yeah, of course I'll do it. You know, and
so I was speaking to a woman yesterday I met who was about my age, and she had a nephew that she didn't know about. A nephew appeared. And the thing she kept coming back to was, well, what choice do I have? You know, realistically, what other, you know, all the assessments in the world, whether there's support or no support, what choice do I actually have? He's my blood. Mm. And there's that tension that no matter what the services are or aren't, more to the point, people don't necessarily feel that they've got a choice, do they?
Yeah, I think that's it, Al. And a lot of people say, you know, they do it, however hard it is, they do it again in a heartbeat because it's the right thing to do, you know. And I think that's why kinship carers have been neglected so long, because they will just do it. You know, they'll put up things. But that doesn't make it right, does it? You know,
no.
and we can see,
no, definitely not.
We go on to talk about the struggles that and challenges that kinship carers have, which are very real, and they don't have some of the support that adopters have. So right from the beginning, things like no time off, you know, no right to paid time off work. If you're a special guardian and you know, you're a grandmother, you picked up a baby from hospital, you're going to look after that baby forever, but you have no right to paid time off work. So those grandmothers are often still working because the retirement age has gone up.
Yeah.
They're giving up work. They're not necessarily entitled to a decent financial allowance. So we're plunging people into poverty, and that poverty will continue. Those, essentially, we're saying, okay, it's the benefit system for you. That's where they're sent to look for support. And, you know, they know that their financial future has just gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's that we were with a group of women who, they were all in their 50s, they'd all given up work to become kinship carers, and they kind of talk about feeling, you know, feeling impoverished, an impoverished future. It's that sense of, I'll have no money today, tomorrow and forever. It's, that's it.
It's a pretty desperate outlook, isn't it?
Yeah, being broken system that can't recognise that somebody who is raising a newborn baby can't have that right to paid time off work. So I hope some of those things will be sorted fairly soon, because it's so obviously not right.
Yeah. Added to that, do you think there's a stigma about that can be, that can come with those circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, kinship carers do talk about that. It's the impact on their relationships is huge, and I think that's partly because of their stigma. So often what we find is that their relationships change. So friends might drop away because of what's happened or because of the needs of the children, and they're almost a bit out of kilter with what's going on. So if you're 60 and you're suddenly looking after toddlers, your friends are not doing that.
Yeah.
You're not even with a peer group who are going through some of the same things. And then there is that feeling of, you know, perhaps it's my fault. Even if, you know, rationally, they know it's not, they can still feel that. And that... that balancing of how do you keep maybe the grandchildren safe, but also maintain that relationship with the mother or the father, which is the reason why they weren't safe. I mean, it's so complicated.
Yeah, and I guess there must be a stigma that the potential of for people to feel that, you know, that people are whispering behind their back, well, if you'd raised your own children properly, you wouldn't be looking after your grandchildren or your niece or nephew or whatever combination of relations, which is again just further isolating, further excluding people from their peer group.
Yeah, I think that's why. And I mean, there is 70% of people in our survey said they felt anxious, stressed, and isolated. So you know that they are definitely feeling that. We as a charity will tackle that head on, because actually becoming a kinship carer can happen to anyone, and we absolutely see that. So I think it doesn't take long for most of us to realise there's someone we know who has become a kinship carer.
Yeah.
So, you know, because it happens for this sort of, you know, plethora of reasons. But obviously, if you're a kinship carer because... maybe, you know, somebody died, it's different from if you become a kinship carer because, you know, your child's gone to prison, or, you know, is involved in you know, drugs or something. So yeah. I think there's definitely something for kinship carers about wanting to come together as kinship carers, but then almost come together with people who understand what they're going through specifically.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like imprisonment. We know that with one of our projects, the grandparents who were looking after children because of that, they were reluctant to come to a general peer support group because they felt that sense of difference and stigma and things like that. So, you know, sometimes we're going to have to do things for separate groups.
Yeah.
Which makes it quite difficult, actually, doesn't it? Because when you've got that, I mean, there's a couple of things that you said, and I'm thinking, wow, you've started off talking about them, and I'm like, oh, that happens with us as well. But the background to it is really different. The reasons for it happening are really different. But there's still a lot of synergies, which I think is really interesting. And it must be very difficult as a service, because I know that I have similar issues in terms of the kind of the different sort of backgrounds to even the doctors bringing them together. If they've got teenagers or if they've got young children, and some, you know, sometimes never the twain will meet, I guess. So it puts a lot of pressure on a charity to be able to provide as much as they can when it's not available.
Yeah, I think certainly for those kinship carers who, you know, they've been a bereavement, it's really difficult. There's another carer who has, she came to see the children's minister with me, and she talks about looking after her two, she's lone pensioner, was looking after her two granddaughters while their mum went to hospital for an operation. And mum died. So she lost her only daughter, and her granddaughters lost their mum. And she was thrown into this situation, which I can only describe as just hostile in every way. So she was told that she'd voluntarily looked after the girls when mum was in hospital, so it was a private arrangement. And she says, I did not expect my daughter to die. She was living in a small flat that she bought for her retirement. She gave up her bed for the girls. She slept on the sofa for 7 years. She was told that she didn't qualify for any support, so she was going to the food bank. She then did what you would all want to happen, I think. She wanted to keep some stability for the girls, so although she lived in a different town, she drove the girls to their same school and sat in the car outside all day because she couldn't afford the petrol home. And I just think, this is what's happening. And you know, for someone like that, actually the need for support for her and for the girls is so substantial. And it's not just about being in kinship care, it's about the loss of someone and grief. And yet the system didn't provide any support at all.
It's outrageous, isn't it?
It's disgusting, actually. It's not outrageous, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
So she told the children's minister she slept on a sofa for 7 years and she was in her 70s. And, you know, we know that kinship carers are doing things like that, and it goes back to that thing, you're doing the right thing, and then it's almost like, well, what else could I do? And she wanted to do that. Of course she would do that. But yeah, if you come into kinship care like that as a child or young person, you do not qualify for any particular support.
What did the minister say at that? I'd be interested.
Me too.
Yeah, so we are trying to get groups of carers in front of MPs and the children's minister, and I think a lot of people can immediately connect. They can see that this is wrong and there's an awful lot of sympathy. The challenge for us is moving it from sympathy on to action.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in this climate, it is really hard, you know, to get anything on the national policy agenda. And, you know, within a climate of, you know, austerity and local authorities really struggling with the costs of statutory services.
Yeah.
So I think there's an understanding and there's sympathy. It's for us, it's about, okay, now we need to do something.
Yeah. I mean, can I ask about, because one of the things I've noticed is that the landscape is quite a jigsaw across the nation in relation to special guardians and kinship carers. It seems like there's lots of small groups within communities, but there's very, I mean, you're one national voice, but there's not a, like Adoption UK kind of speaks for an awful lot of the adoption community. Is there a comparison within special guardians, or is there work to kind of bring this into one voice and one community?
So in the northeast of England, where we had lottery funding to develop with kinship carers peer support groups. So we've worked, you know, right from the Northumberland down to Teesside to set up support groups which become carer led. And what happens in those support groups is it's kind of a grassroots up type of approach. So people are coming as kinship carers, whatever their legal order, and they really come together around what's unique and shared in their experiences. What we find in London, where we now work, is that the local authorities are more advanced in their work with special guardians. So local authorities have set up peer support groups for special guardians. So you find that special guardians are coming together as a group, and they might refer to themselves as SGs. You know, there's almost like this identity growing around special guardianship.
Yeah.
But it there's a difference in different parts of the country.
Right.
Because I think that follows where local authorities have got a strategy, where they are putting resource in, where they're almost like building a program of support for special guardians. And what we would say is it's really important that all those services are opened up to kinship carers. So if there's a special guardian support group, we'd say, please open it up to your kinship carers. In the same way as we would say, it makes sense to open up some of your training that's put on for foster carers.
Yeah.
For foster carers too. So like just, you know, use the existing resource, because there are some common themes that people are dealing with. I've forgotten your original question now, Al.
It was probably quite dull, if I'm honest with you.
It was something, there's a patchwork,
yeah.
Do we have one group? So what for us, there's this thing about, there's a kinship care community that to some degree Grandparents Plus tries to represent. So about 4,000 kinship carers are in our network. Well, you know, there might be 300,000. So the best data we have is from Bristol University's assessment, tells that about 200,000 carers, so, you know, maybe 300,000 kinship carers. We don't know. So, you know, one of the key things the government needs to do really is to look at better data. You know, if we care about these children, we have to know who they are, where they are, you know, and then we can start to look at their experiences and outcomes.
Scott, I was going to ask you, because you obviously work at a national level about adoption, and obviously I guess the cry often is same children, just different circumstances. Do you think there's ever going to be a time, it's a question for you both really, do you think there'll ever be a time when adoption and kinship care will kind of merge into a much bigger, potent voice?
In a word, from me anyway, I don't think they'll ever merge.
Right.
Because I think there's a lot of synergies in terms of the children, but they're not the same children because the experiences are very different. You know, we have an adoption system that's closed. It's a closed system, and that's not how, in my eyes anyway, that's not how kinship and special guardians and connected persons works. Because, you know, Lucy's made some examples there of where parents have passed away and stuff like that. That's very different because they're not going to have that contact, but they've got that loss. But it's a permanent loss, isn't it? It's not like, you know, the risks to our children when they reach 18 or when they reach social media age of being able to access that. So I think it's very different. I think there's some synergies in the way we can support the people who are looking after, whether they're parents or carers or, you know, But I don't, for me anyway, I don't think the two could ever merge to be as one. I think if you were going to class it as a permanence option, so if you're looking at all types of permanence for a child and making an assessment based on the needs of the child, it could fall under a permanence kind of umbrella, which it does already. But I think that they've never been brought together in the way that, you know, I'm conscious that we need to try and bring together, because actually, if we can, I guess what I'm trying to say is that these kinds of permanence all need to be supported. And the people who are looking after these children need to be trained and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's what's key. So there needs to be some form of umbrella, and there needs to be, you know, organisations, you know, like Adoption UK, like Grandparents Plus, like, you know, TACT. We need to all be working together. And that's not to say that's the only three I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of a lot more than that. But we all need to be working together to come to a solution where, you know, these kind of types of permanence are all supported. But we know... You've got me fired up now, Al.
Blood up.
But yeah, but we also know that, you know, even adoption isn't perfect.
No, definitely.
And I think that that's where my kind of my heart is pulled, because actually adoption isn't perfect. And we know that, but actually we have it in terms of support. At least it's recognised that we need it.
Yeah.
And that's not where kinship care is. And,
absolutely.
And you know, I totally agree with what Lucy said about SGOs. There was a point where SGOs just fired up through the roof. And I remember it happening. And, you know, a lot of funding has been taken away from adoption in some ways. And this isn't something that, you know, is probably that well known, but it was to support SGOs. But actually, yeah. What about those groups that Lucy's talking about? So, sorry, I banged on there.
No, as you were saying that, but when I was thinking about coming together, I was thinking, imagine if we... like the education issue that is ongoing for a lot of parents. So if, say, the Fostering Network, Grandparents Plus, Adoption UK came together with one voice and said, we need to support traumatised children in school, that's not just a cohort of 50,000. If those numbers that you're speaking about, Lucy, are right, we're talking about 500,000 people? Half a million children?
I think that would be amazing, because... And I watch the work that Adoption UK are doing with schools. It's phenomenal. And actually what you're doing is raising awareness within schools about what those children have gone through and therefore how the school might respond to them appropriately. Yeah. And I do sit back and I think that would be so relevant for our children too.
Yeah.
And that's where I think, you know, we could definitely work together. I think, you know, there is... For me, you know, I talk about this quite a lot at the Adoption Support Special Guardianship Leadership Board. The kinship carers are the core relation, but equally so are those bodies that support them. So at local authority level, there is varying and sometimes very limited, dedicated support for kinship carers. And then at national charity level, in the voluntary sector, there has been capacity building for years into adoption and fostering. And that's absolutely right, but that has never, ever happened for kinship care. And so it's no surprise that we are the size that we are. And until very recently, you know, it's just a struggle constantly to be funded. And you know, my hope is that as kinship care is more recognised, that and that's at every level. So schools will respond differently to kinship carers; they'll know it exists. Funders will know that kinship care exists, so it will become a priority in the same way as looked after children are a priority, quite rightly. At government level, it will be recognised. So we know that one of the issues for kinship carers is no one's ever heard of it.
Yeah.
So at least if you're an adopter or a foster carer, when you say you're that, someone, they might not understand really what it is, but at least they've heard of that term. Whereas we're even one step back. We've got to often explain what it is. And then, I understand now. But that happens for kinship carers at every turn. So if you approach your housing office, people say, well, I don't understand. If they go and try and get a passport, people say, I don't understand. It's almost like we've really got to start raising awareness and then thinking about where does the system need more capacity to support people effectively.
Tricky. You've got a big job ahead of you, haven't you, Lucy?
It's madness. I know. I was just thinking that as well. Tricky. You know. And because thank you for mentioning the education campaign, Lucy, because I think that that's one of the key things that we have been very aware of from the beginning. I mean, obviously, we're working with some partners in different areas. We're doing this as Adoption UK, and obviously the clue's in the name, isn't it? Adoption. So when we, you know, when we say things, it is about adopted children. But the message that we're trying to get out there is about the fact that, you know, the majority of children in school will have suffered some form of loss of trauma. And in actual fact, by using some of the approaches and strategies that we are, you know, tr- we're we're trying to get them to think about and use, actually it can affect whole school. And that's the key thing, you know. So it doesn't, it shouldn't matter that, you know, what their legal status is, or what their family situation is. Now they should all have that equal chance at school, because they're all being, you know, they're all being accommodated in their own ways. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what happens when we've still got quite an Edwardian school system. And that's been polite about it, to be perfectly frank, because I think it's too rigid for a lot of the children that go there now. And that's not just our kinds of children, so, you know, kinship children, adopted children, foster children. That's, you know, children of single parents. That's children of, you know, all these kind of groups where there's divorce and, you know, things like that. So, yes, they're not in the same, you know, I'm not saying we're categorizing the same, but, you know, that is the key message that we need to get out there, that, you know, the majority of these schools these days have issues with children who don't fit into that that Edwardian system.
Yeah, and there will be a really positive ripple effect from everything you're doing, which will go out to the other children.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, if we're really clever, that at the moment there's an opportunity for, particularly in special guardianship, to think about what's worked really well in adoption. You know, think about this, the kind of training, the ongoing support and so on, and think about where might that move across to kinship care and be effective.
Yeah.
You know, as someone who's come from fostering as well, I tend to look that way as well. So things like peer-to-peer support, it's so obvious, isn't it, as one part of the solution. And, you know, we see that in fostering, we see it in adoption. It works really well in kinship care too.
Yeah.
And, you know, our vision at the very least would be there's a local peer support group wherever you live. So at least you can go there. And it really just, it builds that capacity of the kinship care community as well. So we see, however hard people have, you know, how they found it in their journey through being kinship carer, there are so many who then want to change things and make it better for others. And that's why I think support groups can work so well. So we have, I think now in the Northeast, there's 29 support groups in the Northeast of England. So you can still be a long way from one, particularly in Northumberland, but we have funding from Nesta, the innovation funder, to scale that up. So to look at scale-ups towards our vision of there are groups everywhere, and not just physical groups, but also virtual groups for those who, for whatever reason, can't get to the support group or don't want to get to the support group, there'd be some kind of online support, which I know is much more, again, much more advanced in adoption.
Is that more a reflection of the demographics of kinship carers as well, that they're perhaps a little bit older and they're not like Scott, young and hip, and down with the kids.
I'm just looking at him now.
Don't do that.
I think some of it, it's about age. It's about the fact that in general, kinship carers have less money. So some of the, you know, they might have quite a basic phone, but then they wouldn't have, you know, the swanky iPad. You know, I'm generalizing here, but when we're developing our online pilots, we're looking at trialing WhatsApp, for example. So it's entry level, everybody can do it. We're not making any assumptions that people have got flash kit and lots of time and things. So, you know, the demographic is really interesting, and I think as Grandparents Plus grows our services, we are increasingly not just supporting grandparents.
Yeah.
And even when we look at our grandparents, they are 40 plus. So, you know, they are not, you know, one particular group. And, you know, I've recently, you know, met sibling carers and aunts and cousins and people who are coming along to our things. And some of them are working, they're really, really busy, they cannot go to a support group that meets every Tuesday.
Yeah.
So we know we need to develop probably just a range of options, like any other charity would do. There are some people who are going to want to meet face to face. There's some who prefer to do it online, you know, in the evening. And, you know, again, we have to grow, and we're going to test things and see what works.
Yeah. I'm conscious that we've taken up loads and loads of your time. It's really interesting. I guess I've got a final question. I don't know whether Scott has, but my final question is, you probably have, is...
I've got millions still.
You've got thousands. What do you see the future? Where would you like to see the future go for kinship carers? Magic thinking.
So the big thing would be a Kinship Care Act. We want kinship carers to be seen as a group. We want them to be thought about, services structured to meet their needs, everything. Basically, they need to stop being divided up by legal order. And, you know, that whole square peg in round hole thing. They have a unique set of challenges. They are not the same as adopters, even though some things will be the same. They're not the same as foster carers, although some things will be the same. And yet we've never really thought of them. So we've looked at adoption, we've looked at foster care, we've looked at residential care. We think it's time to look at kinship care. And from that, we would address all the things that we need to address. So, you know, what support is needed through that journey of being a kinship carer, and what support is needed for the children and young people that they're caring for. So our ambition.
It seems reasonable.
No, really reasonable. And you know, along that journey, there are real urgency. I mean, finance is just an unbelievable challenge for kinship carers. So, you know, we know they're dropping out of work because they have to look after the children. You know, we've talked about the lack of parity with adoption leave already. And I think 43% in our last survey said they don't have enough money to meet the needs of the children. And there was Bristol University research found 3/4 of children in kinship care are growing up in deprived households. I mean, I see
3/4
of children in kinship care. You know, I don't look at any stats for, you know, deprived areas and find that level of children. If you put all of our children in a town, they would outstrip any town on child deprivation. It's, to me, it's shocking every time I read that.
It is pretty scary, isn't it? Wow.
So, to me, it's that absolute urgency to deal with that. But at the same time, kinship carers are really vulnerable to cuts. So because there's that lack of entitlement to financial support, they are frightened that even if they have it now, it could be taken away. So, you know, really, really precarious financial situations that they're in.
Wow. Scott, final questions?
Well, it was a similar question, actually, but I just wanted to pin you down a little bit in terms of within your time as CEO, what is the one thing that you want to change? Is it that you want to see the Kinship Care Act, or is there something else that you really, really want to make sure that is done in your time as CEO?
So, I mean, the thing that we are really pushing on is support wherever you live.
Yeah.
So as well as we really focus on raising awareness of kinship care, pushing policy and practice change, but increasing support, and that's the thing that we can do. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, this range of programs which are growing. We have local authorities now commissioning our service, which is called Kinship Connected. We want that everywhere. We are quite open about that. We want wherever you live, whatever your legal order, you should be able to access support. And before that Kinship Care Act comes, we will do our absolute best to make sure that happens.
Well, that is a pretty lofty and
I think you've got us, Lucy. I think you've enraged us.
The piece of power.
And I think it's worthwhile saying it, because I know that we are the Adoption and Fostering podcast. That must get on your wick a little bit as well. In the same token,
I'm not sure she's that bothered.
in the same token, I think that, you know, one of my kind of reflections on this whole conversation is that, you know, we must, in some ways, as adoptive parents, be not an enemy. I don't want to use that word, but we must be like the dread of every kinship carer in terms of what might happen or what could have happened or what might still happen if they're not supported, if they can't have, you know, if they're not trained with the techniques and strategies to be able to parent these children, etc., etc., etc. So I wanted to say, and I think that probably on the majority of on behalf of the majority of the adoption community, is that, you know, we are on your side with this. We do, you know, we know that there's lots of differences, but, you know, we would rather see these children stay with their families as well.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's just one thing on top of another for these children, and it's just so unfair. So I, for one, do take my hat off to kinship carers.
Yes.
And I think that you're all doing a fantastic job in very difficult circumstances. And, you know, yeah, I salute you on behalf of the majority of the adopted community.
Yeah, we want to be allies.
Yeah. We do.
Yeah. I think that's the safe way to go. I mean, because I've worked in fostering and now kinship care, I am absolutely clear that children need the right place for them.
Yeah.
What we're doing wrong is if they're going into one placement, the kinship care option, we're not following that with enough support.
Yeah.
So it's about equalising access to support. And actually, you know, it's not about not recognising that many adopters need more support too. It's just about saying, can we just level this up a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Equity.
Yeah.
For the same children, you know, that's what we have to stand for. And we know that actually some children move between the systems. So,
of course,
you know, children can be fostered and then adopted. They can be fostered, then go into kinship care, go back into foster care. It happens. So let's just be child-led on this.
Yeah.
The needs of the children, not the legal status.
Well, that's why you're the doctor and we're not. Basically.
I only use that on Twitter. Someone got my name first.
I would use it if I had one. I would use it all the time. I'd make my children call me if I had one.
Well, you do. You make them call you MBE as well.
Yeah,
so,
Dad know, MBE, yeah. Yeah. Well, Lucy, thank you. Dr. Lucy, thank you very much for coming on. And I look forward to seeing you if I ever get near the Houses of Power. And if you're there, we shall have a coffee and chit-chat. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lucy.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
I don't know how to turn you off.
No, I get that a lot.
See you. Have you gone? You haven't even gone.
No, I'm still here.
No, we're still here.
Yeah, we don't go. We actually live in the podcast. Don't we?
You can't talk about me yet, so I'm going to keep you running. Bye.
I've no. I think you have to leave. We can't send you away. It's late, Lucy. You must have things you need to do.
I wish I knew how to turn off Skype. That is my.
There's a restraint. Oh,
she's gone. Goodbye, Lucy.
What does this button do?
And she's probably going, oh, I've gone.
Okay. Oh, maybe she hasn't gone. Maybe she's muted and she's listening to what we're going to say next. Right, give me a second and I'm going to press pause and I'm going to start the recorder again.